Welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. David Cameron has broken his silence with extracts from his memoirs published in The Times today, along with an interview. I'm Fraser Nelson, and I'm joined by James Forsyth to discuss. Now, James, the headline of The Times, "I'm failed, I'm sorry," four very damning words for David Cameron's premiership. But do we think this is the tone of the book, one big massive apology for his prime ministership?
I think he starts with quite a good self-deprecatory line about how when Margaret Thatcher was asked what she would do differently if she did it all again, she said, well, it didn't turn out too badly the first time around, did it? And he says, I wish I could say the same. But I also think if you read on, although he is kind of apologetic in the intro, if you see what I mean, the rest of it is written from the perspective of someone who basically thinks that what he did was right. His section on Michael Gove, for example, it's quite clear that his frustration is that Gove wouldn't do what Cameron told him to do. And I think that is a tension. I also think that David Cameron, part of David Cameron's problem, and you see this perhaps more clearly in the interview than in the extracts from the book, is that he still thinks that holding the referendum was the right thing to do. And so he's kind of stuck in this kind of apologetic tone, but he doesn't actually want to say, oh, whoops, sorry, I shouldn't have called that referendum. And that, I think, is his problem. I'm also always struck by this great irony of David Cameron, which is, if Brexit turns out all right in the end, you know, it goes fairly well, which I think there's a large chance it will once we get through this period of negotiating, then I think history might look at some of the other things that David Cameron did, which were undoubtedly good. His problem is that at the moment everything is about Brexit, and he's in this weird position of having said during the campaign that Brexit, during the referendum campaign, that Brexit would be a disaster, but then obviously by having called the referendum being the person who facilitated it.
Yes, it's strange that, I mean, here's a prime minister who, thanks to his reforms, there are millions more people in work. The attainment gap in schools between state and private has never been smaller. Income inequality is near a 30-year low. Pretty decent achievements, yet all of them are overshadowed by Brexit. And this is almost as if nothing else matters. But when we look at the extracts The Times chose to publish today, there are about three or four of them. And I have to say, I almost felt a bit sorry for him seeing those extracts. So you've got the bit where he smoked marijuana at Eton, right? So he portrays himself as being relatively weak-willed pupil who was in the habit of going along with the wrong crowd. And then he rows off to some island, smokes marijuana, almost gets kicked out of school because of it, but luckily doesn't. And then there's his row with Michael Gove. And I guess what strikes me here is that he will have had rows with a lot of people, but it seems to be as if Boris Johnson and Michael Gove are singled out for the most uncharitable treatment. I guess I imagine that that's going to lead up in the book to their sort of personal treachery being to blame for a lot of what went wrong. So he doesn't seem to be, in the extracts we've seen so far anyway, really talking up much of what was achieved in coalition government. But the other interesting thing is that he doesn't really say, actually, he doesn't seem to say, but actually there were a lot of good reasons to vote leave. It's just that I didn't quite understand them at the time. He seems to talk about this in terms of a gamble that failed. But the motive factors are this, are the sort of the ambition, the personal ambition of Boris Johnson. And I guess the slight character flaws of Michael Gove, who is portrayed as a sort of, what does he call him, an eccentric, a passionate eccentric.
I thought he calls him something else, beginning with W, which I'm not sure we can say on this podcast.
Yeah, he calls him, and I imagine when we get the rest of the book, it will probably elaborate on these themes. But it doesn't quite seem, James, as if he's saying, look, I recognise that I just didn't recognise the strength of feeling in the country over this. He still seems to feel he was pretty hard done by.
So if we go back to the referendum, one of the big things that surprised me about that campaign was, I thought that David Cameron was roughly in the Francis Maud position. Francis Maud was, you know, a Tory grandee, now in the House of Lords, son of a former Tory cabinet minister. And his view was the referendum didn't matter that much because the UK's end relationship with Europe, was the EU, was going to end up, you know, in roughly the same place, whichever the result. His theory was we weren't going to join the single currency, we weren't going to go any further down the path of integration, so we would continue to be kind of more and more distant members of the EU. And the question was whether we were kind of distant members on the inside or close partners on the outside with kind of close levels of economic cooperation, but out of lots of the more political stuff. And I thought that was where Cameron was. And I thought Cameron's willingness to call the referendum was because he kind of accepted that analysis. So I remember during the referendum campaign being quite surprised at kind of almost how pro-EU Cameron was, how much of a disaster he thought leaving would be.
Yep. It's funny, James. I remember you and I having a conversation with a cabinet member who was saying that he thought David Cameron was one of the most Eurosceptic members of the cabinet. Now, this would be before Brexit came on the agenda, but I had thought, okay, Cameron's fighting this campaign, in for a penny, in for a pound. Of course he's going to talk as if Britain's future just fundamentally has to be inside the EU, and that the other option, the Leave option, would be a disaster. This is a campaign, you need to exaggerate. So when his book came out, I had thought he might say, actually, it was a far closer argument. I could have supported either side, really. And I just happened to come down on Remain. But in the book, it seems that, if anything, he is every bit as convinced that Remain was the right idea. He seems to be, in other words, a far less Eurosceptic figure than the David Cameron which we thought we knew in, say, 2012 or 2013.
Yeah, and also, in one might say, even a less Eurosceptic figure than the David Cameron who gave the Bloomberg speech setting out his goals for the renegotiation. And I think this is the great frustration of the people in the Labour Party and the Liberal Democrats who'd fought the referendum campaign alongside him, was that they felt that, you know, Cameron had ushered all this in, you know, taking the Tories out of the EPP, setting the bar for the renegotiation really quite high, and then failing to meet it. And that this is what had created the conditions for Brexit. I think in a way, but, you know, again, we come back to this point, which is David Cameron didn't want this book to come out this time last year because he wanted Brexit to be done. Brexit was obviously not done. Brexit is at an even more controversial point. He also kept very quiet during the Theresa May era because he didn't want to be a distraction to his successor. He didn't want to make her job any harder. Yet again, he seemed to have changed tack here because, you know, he is undoubtedly making Boris Johnson's job harder with this book. Now, you can obviously say Boris Johnson ended David Cameron's job essentially by winning that referendum campaign in 2016, so kind of in a way, fair enough. But I think you see how Cameron has got kind of caught here, and I think he's in this position where it's not clear what he can say. You know, even on the second referendum, he gives an answer that will satisfy no one. You know, he says it can't be ruled out, which will irritate those people who remember that, you know, David Cameron repeatedly saying during the referendum campaign that the result would be implemented. It's your decision. Whatever you decide, the government would do. But at the same time, it's not a let's have another vote, we need to fix this, which would have made him a kind of darling of the people's vote campaign. So I think in a way, Cameron is in purgatory until Brexit is sorted.
But if you look at the actual revelations about Michael Gove and Boris Johnson, it doesn't seem as if there's anything that is actually damaging to both of them. He's made clear what he thinks of them and their decisions, but it doesn't seem as if he's revealed anything too damaging, other than this rather striking tale of his Bullingdon Club initiation ceremony, where there were boys standing on an upended table with a golf club swinging at broken bottles. I think the language he says is, I can't swear that Boris Johnson wasn't one of them. I guess he's not saying Boris Johnson was one of them either, but it doesn't seem as if there's anything which is too damning.
Yes, I mean, I suspect the Bullingdon anecdote, you know, given how much trouble that caused David Cameron, but there's a slight malign twist in reminding everyone of Boris Johnson's role in all that.
I suppose he might think to himself, like, why did I get all this hassle over Bullingdon when Boris Johnson was basically up to the same, if arguably worse?
But there's a funny thing about Boris Johnson and David Cameron, which is the old Etonian stuff seems to bounce off Boris Johnson much more. I remember during the Tory leadership campaign, Boris Johnson revealed that he'd been glugging away on this red wine that cost £180 a bottle because he hadn't quite realised how much it was worth because someone had sent him a case of it. And it's the kind of revelation that if it had come out about Cameron, the story would have run for days and days and days. Cameron would have, you know, pulled his hair out over it. Well, as with Boris Johnson, I think it kind of got a chortle and no one remembers it? It isn't even in kind of Labour's attack ads now. You know, you don't even see kind of people on Twitter saying, you know, Boris Johnson, a man who drinks £180 wine, thinks that you can live off, you know, X, Y, Z a week when it comes to welfare. You know, there is an element of that that is, but it somehow it doesn't seem to affect Boris Johnson in the same way it does David Cameron. I think because Boris Johnson exudes an air of not being bothered by it.
But Brexit aside, James, there are parts of his extracts which show you how his character evolved. I mean, when he became leader, he was mocking the neocons. He was saying how you can't drop democracy from 10,000 feet. And then we have the extract from a Libyan intervention where he says that when it came to the impending massacre at Benghazi, he was saying that to fail to act was not a neutral act. If he failed to act, that would be to be complicit in murder. Now, that is very logical, but it is also the logic of liberal interventionism. So we kind of see him go full circle from him mocking neocons, knocking Iraq, to thinking actually standing by and doing nothing in the face of evil is to collaborate with that evil, which is, I guess, precisely what Tony Blair and George Bush were arguing before they decided to invade Iraq.
Yeah, I think that is what happens in a way when you are in office and someone comes to you saying, you can stop this if you choose to act. And I think at that point people feel that it's much more on them, if you like. I also think, to be fair to David Cameron, you know, to borrow a phrase from one of Obama's former advisors, that the West has tried every single option in the Middle East. You know, in Iraq it tried invasion, occupation, trying to reform the government. I think that's fair to say that the results of that have been, to put it mildly, distinctly mixed. In Libya, it tried removing the government and then clearing out of a scene straight away. And in Syria, it's tried non-intervention. And it is impossible to argue that any of those three options have worked well.
Yeah. And do you think that he goes a bit too far in his apologies? I mean, he basically, obviously, he didn't like the referendum result. But I imagine, fundamentally, he offered Britain a way out of the EU, and the country took this choice. Without his referendum, we have not been able to jump off the train, even if the act of jumping has got its risks. But most voters thought, well, not as many risks as staying on. So there will be quite a lot of people, I imagine, picking, especially those who voted Leave, who might think, well, don't be so hard on yourself, David Cameron, because ultimately you gave Britain the chance to get off. And that's a chance a lot of other Eurosceptics in other countries will never be given, because their prime ministers trust the people less than he trusted Britain with this referendum.
Yeah, completely. If David Cameron was differently inclined, you could have argued that the referendum result was the justification for calling it in the first place, that membership clearly no longer commanded public consent when considered. But I think part of the problem is he never really felt like that, and so that is the problem. And as we say, you know, I suspect that if in 20 years' time Britain has left the EU and everything, you know, and the sun still rises in the east and sets in the west, and, you know, and the UK is still a prosperous economy doing well, then I think everyone will start to look at the Cameron government very differently, and he will be able to get a hearing for all of the positive reforms he's made. But while we are still in this Brexit limbo, everything is going to come back to Brexit, and everything is going to come back to people saying, well, why did you have that referendum, and him trying to explain it while also trying to explain why he thinks leaving is a very bad thing.
James, thanks very much indeed. You can subscribe to this podcast, Coffee House Shots, on the iTunes store. Also, I'm interviewing David Cameron on Monday, so are there any subscribers out there who've got good questions for him, then do email me, theeditor@spectator.co.uk. Thanks for listening, and thanks to Gabriel Radonich, who produced the podcast.